All right, we're in Mark, chapter 11. Last class period, we spent a lot of time recapping the whole book of Mark. And the reason why is because what you're going to see from here on is that you're going to see a lot of the issues that we've been tracking for the first 10, 11 chapters will be recapitulating in these following 4 or 5 chapters. So doing a recap last week, I promise you, was not because I was tailor-making our class to the guests in here. It was because that was the time to do it. What was the last class all about, though? In particular, what is happening right now with Jesus in Jerusalem? His authority was being questioned. They come to him and they're asking a question they were asking back in Mark chapter 3. By what authority are you doing this? Although in Mark chapter 3 they just made the accusation, you're doing this by the authority of Beelzebub. What is the source of you walking into our temple, overturning tables, driving all the people out, and stopping the sacrifices for a significant period of time during Passover? Who gives you the right? And how does Jesus respond? Yeah, Jesus responds with a question. He says, now listen, I know you just challenged my honor, but I'm not even convinced that you have the right to challenge my honor because you're assuming we're on the same level. And Jesus says, so let me lay the ground rules for this honor game. Let me ask you a question, and once you answer the question, I'll answer my question, the question you have given me. Which in essence, when Jesus is giving the question, if they give the right answer, they will also be answering the question they asked him, right? They ask him, by what authority? He says, well, by what authority did John the Baptist do his ministry? And if they answer that John the Baptist's ministry was from God, then they would also be saying the same about Jesus, because it was understood Jesus was carrying on his ministry. If they say it wasn't from God, well, then they'd have a problem, because who would get upset if John the Baptist's ministry wasn't from God, according to the Jewish elite? The people. Who thought John the Baptist was what? A prophet, and that'll be important once we get to the parable here in just a minute. So they come along and they say, well, our answer to this question is, we don't know. But not giving an answer in an honor game, in the honor-shame game, is an answer. If you don't respond, it doesn't mean an answer wasn't given. An answer was given. For your lack of response says one of two things. Number one, it either says you don't have a response, because the person has outperformed you, therefore they get the honor. Or it says, you're not worth my time stooping down because you aren't even somebody that can challenge my honor. So no response is a response. The question that people have to ask is, what is the honor status of each people and do they have a right not to give an answer? That's why whenever Jesus says here in just a minute, neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things, he's not giving them an answer either. But I think that the way in which the crowds have reacted thus far, you'd have to interpret the no responses in two different ways. Are you following me? Is this making sense? For the no response by the Jewish elite would probably be received as they don't have an answer to his question. They even admit it in so much as saying, we don't know. But Jesus saying, I'm not going to give you a response, is a totally different proclamation in the honor game. Because in essence, what Jesus is saying is, you are not worthy of me stooping down and giving an answer because you're not on the same plane as me on the honor game. Is this making sense? All right, so let's take a running start at this. Because the parable that we're going to be moving into, the parable of the tenants, is not, even though it's chapter 12 as opposed to chapter 11, is not a major break in this conversation. The same issue is really going to be being discussed. Where is Jesus right now whenever they question his authority? In Jerusalem, but in particular, in the temple courts, on their home turf. Verse 27, they arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders came to him. By what authority are you doing these things, they asked. And who gave you the authority to do this? It's like, can you say it one more way? Jesus replied, I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from men? Go ahead, tell me. They discussed it amongst themselves and said, if we say from heaven, he will ask, then why didn't you believe him? In essence, why aren't you following me? But if we say for men, well, they feared the people, for everyone held that John really was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we don't know. Jesus said, well, neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. And then, it says, he then began to speak to them in parables. Conversation hasn't ended. Jesus is finishing the conversation with the parable. Whenever it says Jesus spoke to them in parables, what does that make you think of? What chapter? Chapter 4. Why? Because chapter 4 explains why Jesus does parables at all. And in light of last class, we need to review why parables were done. Mark chapter 4, verses 11 through 12, says that the reason why Jesus is telling them parables is because they are rebellious people. Mark chapter 4, 11 through 12 says, but to those on the outside, everything is said in parables, so that they may be ever seeing but never perceiving, and ever hearing but never understanding. Otherwise, they might turn and be forgiven. Remember the whole concept that we've been talking with the Synax in chapter 7, in chapter 8, in chapter 10, showing the disciples while they are seeing, they're not seeing, and while they're hearing, they are not hearing. This refers back to chapter 4 with the reason why parables are done. It'll help us to remember the language in the Old Testament of eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear. Ezekiel chapter 12, verse 1 through 2 says, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man. Are you living among a rebellious people? They have eyes to see, but do not see, and ears to hear, but do not hear, for they are a rebellious people. What is the language of eyes to see that do not see, and ears to hear that do not hear? What is it connected to? Rebellion. Same thing in Jeremiah chapter 5, 20 through 25. Announce this to the house of Jacob and proclaim it in Judah. Hear this, you foolish and senseless people, who have eyes but do not see, who have ears but do not hear. Should you not fear me, declares the Lord? Should you not tremble in my presence? I made the sand a boundary for the sea, an everlasting barrier it cannot cross. The waves may roll, but they cannot prevail. They may roar, but they cannot cross it. But these people have stubborn and rebellious hearts. They have turned aside and gone away. They do not say to themselves, let us fear the Lord our God, who gives autumn and spring, rains and season, who assures us of the regular weeks of harvest. Your wrongdoings have kept these away. Your sins had deprived you of good. Notice the context that parables is originally given to us. Mark chapter 4, with the language of eyes that see and ears that do not see, and ears that hear that do not hear. Jesus is saying, the reason why I'm talking to you in parables is because you're rebellious people. And he has his authority questioned in the temple. And immediately he says, all right, I need to talk to you about a parable. What is that saying? And I think the connection's clear, but what is it saying? What is he re-bringing back up? You're proving why I cleanse the temple. You're proving why I curse the fig tree. Your very question shows the problem. And as a result, I'm going to treat you the way you deserve to be treated, like a rebellious people. Mark chapter 4 was quoting Isaiah chapter 6. Mark chapter 4 was quoting Isaiah chapter 6, 9 through 10. And it was a context in which pronouncement of judgment was occurring from God on the nation of Israel that was rebellious, which is what God was lamenting in Isaiah 5. But the key to the fulfillment language is the role in which the rebellious people play in the time of Jesus. So in Mark chapter 4, he quotes Isaiah 6, 9 through 10. You following me? Is it warm in here? You want me to turn on the fans? Is that okay? Seeing people having a tough time. Tomorrow is when I'm expecting you to have a tough time, because some of you will be pulling all-nighters for your paper. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 11, though, is what follows. It's only mean, hold on real quick. It's only mean if it's true. Right? Okay. because those of you that already turned it in, you're sitting there going, pfft. Anyway, okay. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 11, right after what was quoted in Mark chapter 4, says, then Isaiah said, for how long, O Lord? He describes the rebellion in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 6 of Isaiah. And then right after that, In verse 11, Isaiah says, how long will they be left in their rebellion? How long will we leave them in this state? How long will you let them not have the eyes, or allow them to be a rebellious people before you move? And then you have chapter 6:13 through 7:14, which says, how long? Until the Holy Seed comes, Emmanuel, God with us. When He comes, that's when the rebellion will end. And then you have the answer loudly proclaimed in Isaiah 9:2, 6 through 7. It says, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. For to us the child is born, to us the son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. Notice the context that Jesus is referring to, the parables. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Why does Jesus quote in Mark chapter 4? Why does he quote Isaiah chapter 6? I just laid out the whole context for you. Why does he quote for them Isaiah chapter 6, 9 through 10? Because more than it is just identifying their rebellion, it's identifying who he is and what he came to establish. Because if you know Isaiah chapter 6, 9 through 10, you also know what comes through verses 11 all the way through the end of chapter 9. Because it comes off of the lamentation of judgment, which we will be referring to Isaiah 5 in a minute. The reason why I'm going through this whole context is because this entire parable in chapter 12 is based off Isaiah 5. But we've already been talking about Isaiah 6 since Mark chapter 4. Is this making sense? You've got to know the flow in which this question or this parable even comes, or why he's telling parables. Because it's a commentary on Isaiah 5 through 9. So, he gives not just an answer that the reason why I tell them in parables is because they're rebellious, but also because ultimately it points to who I am and what I've come to do. Now, we are able to actually enter into the parable itself. He then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. If you're a Jew, your mind would go to one place. Isaiah chapter 5. No question. Isaiah chapter 5. As a matter of fact, the way it describes what happens with this vineyard, your mind is immediately taken to Isaiah 5. Because it says, a man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower. Let me read Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. This is God speaking. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up, cleared it of stones, and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut a winepress as well. Notice the language. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now, you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. Notice what Isaiah 5 offers. It says, why don't you judge between me and my vineyard? You be the judge. What more could I have done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty, listen to this, is the house of Israel. This is Isaiah chapter 5. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the garden of His delight. And He looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. Why does Jesus go to Isaiah chapter 5? That's not a rhetorical question. Why does he go to Isaiah chapter 5?
To show where the leaders are.
Yeah. They're struggling with the same issues they have since the time of Isaiah. Isaiah 5 is really, this parable is pronouncing exactly what he pronounced in the cleansing of the temple. Same thing. You are in rebellion. Why is it the fig tree comes right before this parable of the tenants? Why was the fig tree cursed? Because it wasn't bearing fruit. And Jesus says, let me tell you a parable. It comes from Isaiah 5. Oh, Isaiah 5. Yeah, you know. It's whenever it shows God's provision in a magnificent way, where He dug the trenches, He built the watchtower, He watered the vineyard, and He goes back for grapes and there was no fruit. And what did He say would happen? Because of your rebellion, I'll destroy my vineyard. For I'll allow it to be trampled. Did not Jesus just say, if you have faith, even this mountain, if you say to this mountain, go throw yourself in the sea, it will. And what mountain was He standing by? The key symbol of their vineyard. The temple. He says, I'll let the Gentiles destroy this too. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the wine press, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. Who is the owner of the who is the landowner and who are the farmers? God is what? The landowner, and the farmers are the Jewish elite. The Jewish elite. And the reason why I'm specifying that is because I believe the whole vineyard is Israel. And in a minute here, the fate of the vineyard will become very clear. But the farmers themselves, the ones that have been renting, are now renting, or have been entrusted the vineyard, is the Jewish elite. So the landowner has responsibilities. He's the one that provides for everything they need for the vineyard. He's the one that dug up. He's the one that's prepared it all. And then he entrusts it to someone else. But they do not own it. Now, they may act like they own it at some point, but they are not the owners. They are those that have been entrusted with it, that are renting it for the landowner to produce fruit for the landowner in exchange for provision. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Understanding where the word servant comes in the Old Testament will allow us to understand what story Jesus is telling. The word servant is the word doulos, which is also what? Slave. The landowner sends one of his slaves. As a matter of, let me read to you several Old Testament texts, and you see if you can understand what the word servant or doulos is probably pointing towards. Jeremiah 7:25. From the time your forefathers left Egypt until now, day after day, again and again, I sent you my servants, the prophets. Jeremiah 25:4. And though the Lord has sent all His servants, the prophets, to you again and again, you have not listened or paid any attention. Amos 3:7. Surely the Lord, sovereign Lord, does nothing without revealing His plans to His servants, the prophets. Zechariah 1:6. But did not my words and my decrees, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, overtake your forefathers? What do you think Jesus, what is the story you think Jesus is saying when He uses the word doulos? The consistent and habitual time after time after time after time when the nation of Israel is in rebellion and God sends His doulos to them, His prophets, to make sure and guide them back to the way in which He wants them to be. Consistently. And how did the nation of Israel treat God's prophets? Over and over and over and over. They beat them. They've ridiculed them. They tortured them. And a lot of times they killed them. And Jesus says, I'm telling you a story that's really just tracing the history of the nation of Israel. What was Isaiah 5 talking about? You can hear God's question. Jesus in Matthew, when He says the same parable, He asks the same question that God asks in Isaiah 5. You judge between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done? Should I have sent you one more prophet? Is that what you needed? Sent you one more of my servants? Even when you recognized they were my servants, how did you treat them? What more could I have done to have you produce some sort of good fruit? He says in verse 2, at harvest time I sent my servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. There was no fruit. Then he sent another servant to them. Now notice the difference, the specificity in the description of the servant in verse 4. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. Who do you think that could possibly be referring to in the Gospel of Mark? Why? You say John the Baptist, and I want to know why. I think that you're right. Because there's two things that have been stated very clearly in Mark's Gospel about John the Baptist. Number one, he is a prophet. How is he introduced in Mark chapter 1? For Isaiah says, a voice is calling in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight his paths. He's a prophet. And what have we just seen in the verses just leading up to this? What did the people think he was? A prophet, a doulos of God. And he was struck on the head. That's the way you guys treated him. Now you start to understand even more clearly of why Mark chapter 6 occurs. We have the flashback moment whenever you have Herod that's asking the question, who is this Jesus? I know who he is. He's John the Baptist that's resurrected from the dead. You start to think back of every time John the Baptist was spoken of. And you see John the Baptist, number one, was in the category of doulos, and that he was the one that was struck on the head and killed and treated shamefully. What are a couple of other places John the Baptist surfaces in the Gospel of Mark?
The disciples' identity.
Yeah, it's usually identity issues around Jesus, is it not? Jesus says, who do the people say that I am? And they say, well, you know, the people say, some say you're John the Baptist. Others say that you're Elijah or Jeremiah, one of the prophets. One of the prophets. And Jesus says, oh no, you guys are right. Matter of fact, he is answering his own question here, is he not? When Jesus looks at him and he says, John the Baptist, where was he from? They say, we don't know. Jesus gives us an answer here in chapter 12. He says, I'll tell you where he's from. He's one of the doulos of God. It's one of his prophets. And how did you treat him? You struck him on the head and treated him shamefully. Verse 5. Oh, but the landowner sent another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, oh, surely they will respect my son. But the tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him and the inheritance will be ours. The logic of the renters, of the farmers, makes a lot of sense, of the tenants. It makes a lot of sense. Because if the landowner sends his son, what are some of the assumptions that you could possibly make? Maybe the landowner himself is dead. Because why would the landowner send his son? I understand if he sends his servants. That makes total sense. But man, if he sends his son, maybe that means the vineyard's up for grabs. Maybe the son is coming to claim his inheritance. But if we knock off the son, then guess who gets the vineyard? We do. We do. It's a power play. Who will control the kingdom? Who will control the inheritance of the landowner? Oh, he may have sent his son. But if we take care of the son, we will keep the power. You see how it could have happened, the thought process of the tenants? If we kill the son and we take the inheritance, we will own everything that the landowner at this point owns. Martin, did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, it was about the inheritance. Because they weren't like a part of the family or anything like that, wasn't it more so like like taking a possession of instead of like a physical taking a possession? Because this is my exegetical or passage.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and explain your question one more time.
Like, because they're not a part of like the family. He's not there. The tenant's not part of the family to the owner. Mm-hmm. So taking like the inheritance of doesn't really make sense. Like, isn't it more so the taking a possession of, like the physical taking a possession of?
I'm not sure. The physical taking possession of the inheritance.
Yeah, the vineyard or whatever, you know, like, because the vineyard is what they're trying to, you know, take a hold
of. Well, they're trying to keep hold of what they already have a tentative possession of.
Yeah.
But now, what I guess I don't think I understand.
Ownership, like, am I right?
Yes. I mean, they want the power. They want control of the vineyard. Complete control. Instead of somebody coming to collect the fruits, they want to continue to keep the fruits to themselves, even though they weren't giving away the fruits to the people coming to collect it anyway. They don't want somebody that actually lays claim to the possession of the land that they want. And even though it is the son's inheritance, if they kill the only son of the landowner, who's going to claim the land?
Kind of because they have never seen the Lord as separate. I mean, the owner of the vineyard prior to, correct?
No, they have seen him. They,
from the beginning, but I mean, it says he's gone away.
Right. And so the assumption could be that the landowner is gone, maybe even dead, because why else would the son be coming here? Maybe to lay claim for what is now his inheritance. So their thought is, if we get rid of the son, see, that's the major mistake. The way in which the Pharisee or the Jewish elite, as well as these tenants, are functioning is as if God himself isn't the one still reigning. That's the key problem. Is that they're acting as if they can do whatever they want, and they're free from accusation. That they're free from punishment. As if God himself wasn't really the one reigning. So it doesn't matter if his prophets come, they'll do whatever they want to him to preserve their power.
So I was doing some research, and it says, like, in the Mishnah, it claims that the tenants would not be able to just take the property for their own. But the rabbinic law states that if the owner abandoned hope of recovering the ownership of the stolen property or lost property, it was no longer his to claim.
Okay. Yeah, but they're not looking to inherit anything, they're looking to seize it.
Just keep it.
Yeah. And the way that you do that is get rid of anybody that holds claim to the inheritance. Is this making sense? Is everybody following? And even, be careful quoting the Mishnah, by the way. And the reason why I say that is because that's oral statements that are collected a couple hundred years after this. And you, if you can trace it back to some sort of oral tradition that occurs around the time, then you have some legitimacy. But I'm always nervous whenever Mishnah is brought up, because because it's oral traditions that who knows if it's really accurate at the time in which it was being occurring. Even still, I would say what you said in the Mishnah doesn't really mitigate or even come up against what I'm saying here. It still reaffirms it. It's saying there's only one way in which the inheritance can be given to you, and the tenants didn't have the right to claim ownership unless they got rid of the ones that laid a claim on the land itself. Then it's free. Then who is going to be claiming this? And the tenants would say, us. Because we're the ones that own it. Now, I mean, who else is claiming it? We are. He put us in charge of it at some point. Therefore, if he's gone and the son's gone, he probably would want us to continue to have control. Yeah, did you have something, Blake? But he is kind of saying it's similar to the conversation of, hey, we want a sign from heaven. You fed the 4,000, you fed the 5,000. We want a sign from heaven. And Jesus says, I'm not giving you a sign. Why not? Because I've given you tons of signs. What more do I need to say, or what more do I need to do to prove to you that I am who I say I am? What else do you need me to do? That's what he's saying. He's saying, you have eyes to see, but you're choosing not to see. You have ears to hear, but you're choosing not to hear. You're the reason why you're missing me is because your hearts are convinced or are submitted to rebellion. It's not because I haven't been clear. It's because you're refusing to see the signs both from me and from God. That you are in rebellion. You see the issue? So yeah, I'm saying that the reason why they are not seeing who Jesus is because they're rebellious, not because he's not being clear.
I haven't asked that question before. If the Pharisees knew that Jesus was God and that if they were trying to kill God, if they thought they could kill God. And I didn't know how to respond to that because I've never seen anything like that before, and this is the only evidence that I've ever heard.
Yeah, what I would say, though, asking the question if they knew who Jesus was and did they know he was God, I think are two different questions. What I mean by that is did they have a full understanding of who Jesus was, like the incarnated deity? I don't think I could argue that. Because I don't think that fit in their paradigm any way, shape, or form. How could they argue against that he was from God? It's the same question that he asked about John the Baptist. He's answering the question of his authority. Where did I come from? So whether or not they understand the intricacies of the incarnation is neither here nor there. Because that, no, I do not think that they would have fully understood the concept of the incarnation. But by what authority he is functioning? Oh, they could have easily made that conclusion. Easily. And what is Jesus claiming to be? They've even said in their hearts, who can forgive sins but God alone? That's already been brought up in Mark chapter 2. So the inclination of the magnitude of Jesus, that's why they asked the authority question to begin with, is because they have a suspicion of who he's claiming to be and they're not willing to accept it. Is that making sense? Ultimately, what they're lusting for more than anything, the reason why they refuse to accept who Jesus is because they want the power of the vineyard. And Jesus' whole message is, power's redefined, everything's redefined in me. So those of you that are clinging on to the power of this world, that's defined by this world and the ways of the world, you'll lose all of it. But if you submit and follow me and you pick up your cross, then we can really get something done. Oh, that's so foolish, I'll kill you. Okay. Even though I'm from God, you're not from God, you can't be. They have eyes to see, but they're not seeing. They have ears to hear, but they are not hearing. So whether or not, I'm not going to psychoanalyze them and say, well, they understood Jesus 70% of the way, but they just missed the last 30. I can't do that. What I can say is he's been very clear by what authority he's been functioning all throughout the first 11 chapters of Mark. And they're refusing to acknowledge it because of the ramifications on their own ministry. That's why they're upset. They won't be the sole owners of the vineyard anymore. Because ultimately the message of the servants being sent from God is, you're in rebellion. Does that make sense? Other questions before we move on? Yeah.
It also seems like that after the... I can't remember what it's called in chapter 9. I'm brain fart right now.
Okay.
Chapter 9.
Like Transfiguration?
Yeah, the Transfiguration. Okay. Even though they know he's the chosen one of God, that they don't see him as God, his deity, because they still call him teacher afterwards, and it still seems like do they realize that he is God incarnated, or they just think he's another prophet, just a chosen prophet?
Well, now, the disciples were the only ones, the inner three, the only ones that saw the transfiguration, and even they were missing the boat on the full understanding of Jesus.
Was the understanding before then was saying that he was going to be God? You know, like, was the chosen one of God supposed to be God reincarnated in the first place?
There was not an understanding in Jewish literature of the Messiah being the incarnated God. That was outside of their understanding. You don't have Old Testament passages. I mean, you have some that come close to that. But you don't have evidence of them looking. They were looking for an agent from God, but they weren't expecting God himself. Does that make sense? Throughout Jewish messianic thinking, and not even everybody was looking for a Messiah, believe it or not. There were some understandings in the Judaism at the time of the first century that God would intervene, but he didn't necessarily have to do it through a Messiah. He could just do it himself. And then you kind of conflate those two and you have Jesus. But no, I mean, the incarnation is not what Jesus needed to prove in this moment. What he needed to prove is by what authority he was there to begin with. And the implications of who he was can be meted out once people are reflecting upon his ministry as a whole. Because ultimately, Mark chapter 2 is something that's quite significant. Because he's not just doing the things that prophets did. Nevertheless, before we can even get to the implications of the Christological understanding of the incarnation, first question we have to be able to answer is, by what authority is he doing these things? First question we have to answer is, by what authority? And they're still at first question. So once you answer the authority, by the authority of God, then you can start saying, then who is he? You see what I mean by that? Is that making sense? Before I can get to the Christological implications of the incarnated God, I have to be able to first answer the question, he came from God. And they don't even have that question down yet. So theologically, we're asking questions that are simply beyond the purview because they're not even able to get past Jesus 101. You know, does that make sense? The implications of the incarnation would come in at least 201. And we're still in 100 level. Following me? Any other questions on that, Skyler?
The sun imagery and the parable.
Mm-hmm.
Can that be referred back to chapter 1?
How so?
First verse.
Mm-hmm.
With the, this is the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Mark's thesis, I mean, of Jesus being the Son of God, Jesus has been called Son of God 5 times thus far in the Gospel of Mark. Mark 1:1, Mark 1:11, 3:11, 5:7, 9:7. 5 times he's been called Son of God. He's called himself or been called Son of Man 9 times. 2:10, 2:28, 8:31, 8:38. 9:9, 9:12, 9:31, 10:33, 10:45. And he's been called Son of David 2 times. 10:47, 10:48. So the concept of Son is deeply embedded into the Gospel of Mark thus far. Both for those on the inner three, all the way out to the crowds themselves. Both literarily and a part of the narrative. Son of God language has been, being the Son, having that authority, has been widely communicated both in word and deed all the way throughout the Gospel of Mark. It's just that the rebellious hearts are choosing to obey what they see and to heed what they hear. So yeah, absolutely. What you would want to do at this point, whenever he brings up a Son imagery, is ask, how many times thus far in the Gospel of Mark has the Son language been used referring to Jesus? And at that point, the identity of the Son becomes very clear, both within the parable and for those hearing the parable. They know what Jesus is claiming to be. It's just that they don't want to accept that. Because ultimately, the way in which the kingdom he is fighting for and the ways in which he is fighting, they're not willing to submit to. Because in the parable, how are the tenants constantly reacting to what they don't like? Violence. Same thing Jesus indicted them for just the last chapter, was it not? And matter of fact, we need to finish this, and this is actually quite funny. It depends on how you define the word funny, I guess. Verse 8. So, seeing the Son come, says, so they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. This is like the fifth time in the Gospel of Mark that Jesus once again has predicted his own death. He says, so how are they going to react? They're going to kill the Son, because that's what they do. And then Jesus says, verse 9, what then will the owner of the vineyard do? Kind of sounds like Isaiah 5. You judge, people of God, what should the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Did you hear that? What did that just say? Israel, because of the way that they've reacted consistently to the prophets and to the Son, Israel will no longer belong to them. It will be given to someone else. And the someone else is measured not by ethnicity, but by faith in Jesus. The kingdom is being transferred from those that claim it to the ones that belong to Him. Whoops. Verse 10, haven't you heard this scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. The Lord has done this and it is marvelous in their eyes. Do you know what passage Jesus just quoted? Psalm 118, verses 22 through 23. Why is that significant, friends?
Because he quotes Psalm 22.
Well, he'll quote Psalm 22 in just a minute. But why is quoting Psalm 118, 22 through 23 significant? What's that?
Is that their battle cry?
Because we Psalm 118, yes. Psalm 118, number one. At the time of Passover, the people would be singing a series of psalms. Psalm 113 through 118. That's the ones that they're called the Hallel Psalms, and that's the one they're singing. And whenever Jesus comes in the triumphal entry, what was the psalm they cried out? The first one, not Psalm 148, but the first one. Psalm 118. For they cried out, Psalm 118, verse 26, whenever they said, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." It was their battle cry. Pick up arms, it's time to fight. And Jesus says, you want to know how this battle is going to be fought? You need to go four verses earlier. For the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. The irony is, who are the builders? The tenants. The Lord has done this and it is marvelous in their eyes. Jesus saying, oh, I'm establishing a kingdom. Psalm 118 is very appropriate. But it will not be the kingdom that you lay claim to right now. As a matter of fact, that kingdom is being taken away from you and given to the people that follow me. Oh, and how do you think they're going to react? Verse 12. Then they looked for a way to arrest him because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. We get the indirect interpretation from them. They're saying, he's talking about us. He's taking the kingdom from us. And Jesus says, well, you got the parable right, but your reaction has been quite predictable. Because what did I indict you for? Killing the people of God, the Son of God. And how do you respond? By wanting to look, arrest, and kill me. He's saying, what else do I need to do? You judge between me and the vineyard. For I've come and I'm not finding fruit. What do you want me to do? We're going to kill you if you say, take it away from us. And Jesus says, I know. And the beauty of it is, as Psalm 118 says, that's how we win. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. But they're still playing a game. They're afraid of the crowd because at this point the crowd's not chanting, crucify him. They're still somewhat yelling, Hosanna. But ultimately their reaction, Jesus says, that's the problem. You've turned my house, the Lord's house, into a den of laestes. And you yourselves are functioning that way. And that's why the king will be taken away from you and given to those that follow me. Those are fighting words. That'll get you crucified. Love you. See you in the morning.